Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling. I hope everyone had a great few days since the last podcast launched. Coming up on today's show, we're going to be talking about holiday shopping projections coming out, also looking ahead to AutoZone and Stitch Fix earnings next week. Our interview guests are Nick Guillen and Nick Agiloni, the co-founders of Truff. They're going to join us to discuss the process behind getting a product, a new product, started from scratch, not affiliated with a major brand or anything like that, an independent product, onto the shelves in retailers throughout the country. Truff is basically a hot sauce with truffle as a key ingredient. The first of its kind, really, and the first, what you could say, premium hot sauce, or hot sauce that exists in the premium space. So a lot of interesting facets to this interview, and I think you'll find their input interesting. A reminder that you can like us and rate us however you access us, whether that be on Amazon, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or any other podcast listening service. Also, we're on social media at Retail Podcast. So let's get right into it. And this is something we talk about every year right around this time, but Deloitte has released their holiday shopping projections. Now, for perspective, last year they called for retail sales increases during the holidays in the 4.5% to 5% range. This was a bit more bullish than were NRF's projections. Those called for increases between 3.8% and 4.2%. I think it's important to look at historical projections because you get an idea of where a certain company comes in. Typically, though, NRF, their chief economist, Jack Kleinhens, they typically come in on the upper end of expectations. Deloitte comes in somewhere in the middle. Last year, it was flipped. Deloitte was far more bullish. In reality, the NRF's measurements actually saw holiday sales go up 4.1%, which was right in the middle of NRF's projected range, but slightly below the lower end of Deloitte's projections, which again, 4.5 to 5%. So last year, putting it all in perspective, Deloitte a little bit bullish. Historically, though, it's important to note that Deloitte's numbers have been in the middle range of projections regarding holiday spend. Additionally, before we talk about this year's projections, we should mention that because Deloitte is often the first firm to make projections, you see projections from other firms certainly a little bit earlier, but Deloitte's kind of like the major one that kicks off the holiday shopping projections with NRF and others following up. Because they're the first here, they are at a slight disadvantage. You think back to 2018, for example, where Deloitte produced their projections in September, and then suddenly macroeconomic uncertainty, which no one was really projecting in terms of using that to bake in for the retail numbers, that hit hard really starting in mid-October. Continued through the final 3 months of the year, impacted holiday sales negatively, and that's something that Deloitte's numbers, of course, couldn't take into account simply because they came out so early. So all of that providing you perspective regarding these projections, and this year for Deloitte, the expectations have been tailed back a bit. Spending still expected to go up versus 2019, and I think that's the big headline. I think a lot of people, maybe not familiar with the retail industry, saw that, and it raised their eyebrows a little bit because, again, you think of everything that's going on in 2020 and certainly the pandemic, the number one thing that's been going on. You think of still some areas with store closures, still some areas with mall closures, but Deloitte is still projecting holiday retail sales to increase between 1 and 1.5% during the November to January timeframe that they have set, at least, as the holiday retail sales window. Now, those of you that listen to the show, that seems like a pretty reasonable expectation because we talk week after week. There are some retailers that are struggling with the pandemic, but there are also many retailers that have been able to take advantage of the pandemic to capture market share. And we're seeing same-store sales at some retailers go up double digits. So it makes sense that holiday spending would be expected in aggregate, in the macro, to go up over last year, even if it doesn't meet last year's 4.1% increase over 2018. However, and this is fairly rare for Deloitte, they hedged on their projections somewhat by noting that sales growth is going to be dependent on which scenario plays out. And again, talk about all of these scenarios, this is why basically no retailer is forecasting sales for the next two quarters. Widespread uncertainty throughout the landscape, not only with the pandemic, but certainly secondary and tertiary impacts from the pandemic. Not a lot of retailers out there are giving you sales projections. And so Deloitte, well within certainly reason to issue two sets of projections here. The 1 and 1.5 is kind of an aggregate expectation for them. But the first scenario, and this is a scenario where Deloitte expects retail sales to be flat versus last year to maybe up 1% from last year. This scenario would see overall sentiment continue to be somewhat negative, people remaining cautious about finances, and they would then ferret the funds away, especially high-income earners, maybe saving funds, worried about what might come next. Now, this scenario might come to roost if you don't see a rebound in unemployment over the next month or two, if you don't see any appreciable progression towards a vaccine in the next month or two. I don't think anyone expects a vaccine to be in place, certainly by, say, December, but even positive news on that front would kind of release the wallets, if you will, and release the holds on those wallets from those high earners. Now, the second scenario where Deloitte expects retail sales to grow 2.5 to 3.5% over last year would see a gain in confidence among wealthy consumers, the willingness to spend. And it's interesting because Deloitte has always been clear that their model and their model's expectations are largely based around wealthy consumers. And it's difficult to talk about a little bit because you certainly don't want to seem disingenuous about, well, low-income earners don't matter as far as retail numbers are concerned, because they absolutely do, and they do for a number of different retail industries. But with Deloitte's projections, wealthy consumers, they've seen in the past, make up a disproportionate share of not only retail sales, but retail sales increases. Those that are willing to spend and those that are high-income earners make up a bigger chunk of those increases than low-income earners, even if low-income earners are having, by standards, a good year. Now, Deloitte classifies their high spender or wealthy category as the top 20% of holiday spenders. Last year, for example, they expected these top 20% to spend $2,100 or more during the holiday season and account for 60% of the overall holiday spend. So again, you're talking about the top 20% accounting for 60% of the holiday spend. That's why Deloitte is looking at this particular income group. However, if this group of consumers has reason for concern, as you look in lower income groups, especially those that work in service industries, the hospitality industries, those groups have reason for concern right now. It would make sense for retail sales to be closer to flat if those concerns trickled throughout all spending groups. Now, Deloitte went even further into potential factors that would influence the higher income group of spenders. You don't always want to conflate higher income with higher spending because it's not a perfect one-to-one analog, but for the purpose of Deloitte's numbers and Deloitte's expectations, certainly it makes sense to group that in because you might have outliers, but on the whole, again, they're making macro projections here for retail sales. And it's an interesting balance because Deloitte said basically for retail to see increases among this group, the group of high spenders, economic recovery must be seen and virus impacts must be mitigated, but only to a limited extent. So it's kind of a weird middle ground that retail is playing. Deloitte noted that falling unemployment, of course, that's going to be key to getting high earners to spend because they'll have more confidence due to reduced economic uncertainty there and more movement towards an effective vaccine, as we talk about, will also in theory help. However, the recovery for retail sales to go up, the projected 2.5 to 3.5% that we talked about in the best case scenario for Deloitte, recovery can't be too good before the holiday shopping season. And that sounds odd, but here's what we mean by this. Because this group must be able, in theory, to funnel spending away from sporting events, concerts, vacations, any type of experiential spending, and to, instead, retail spending. So basically, things must be effectively controlled and unemployment must go down, but they can't be controlled too well such that traveling opens back up. Because if traveling has continued to be throttled, then that's the best case scenario for retail. And that sounds absolutely absurd to say because overall you wish that a rising tide certainly would lift all boats and so forth. But in this circumstance, according to Deloitte's projections for retail sales, to go up as much as 3.5% over last year, high-income earners, high spenders, can't spend that money anywhere else. You have to take away those options. So none of the concerts, none of the experiential stuff, none of the traveling. Travel restrictions also from the U.S. to other countries will probably assist in that if those persist. So just a number of things on the macro level to keep an eye towards that could certainly lead to higher than expected retail sales. Now, finally, the expected portion of the projections here, I think everyone knew e-commerce sales will continue to see drastic and dramatic year-over-year growth. Deloitte, they project an increase of 25 to 35% in e-commerce sales. That's a fairly wide swath, a difference of 10% between the higher and lower, again, owing to unknowns. And this would be a dramatic jump over the 14.7% increase we saw in e-commerce holiday sales last year. However, as with overall holiday spending, there are a lot here. For one, what will the state of the shipping industry be? We've talked about it a lot over the last several weeks. The major players increasing peak charges to retailers. How will retailers respond to that? We haven't even seen the peak holiday season, holiday shopping season yet, and we're already seeing those peak charges come into play. It's expected that the holiday shopping season will push earlier into October this year with Prime Day, as we talked with Danny Cushion about. What's the state of the shipping industry going to be surrounding that? Basically from October to December, because you've got peak times expected to be extended, peak charges extended, and all of this for something we don't even know if the major shippers can perform on. We don't know. There's not really a proof of concept for things being shipped other than when we saw panic buying along the early portions of the pandemic. Coupled with the increased struggles of the Postal Service, which have gotten worse since the beginning of the pandemic, will retailers attempt to push buy online pickup in store? As prior guests on the show have indicated, and as Duluth Trading, we mentioned last week, they're fighting to do that very same thing because of that shipping uncertainty. Overall, you look at these numbers again, 25 to 35% increase in e-commerce sales. That means more people using e-commerce. This could be a tipping point for the retail industry as a whole. If people are able to get orders fulfilled with no problem, then e-commerce momentum will continue. It might continue at the cost of the retailers because of these peak charges and because things have been so expensive in terms of fulfillment, but at least you'll see that momentum continue. If not, and people place orders prior to last-minute deadlines in December, whatever that might look like, and packages are delayed or packages are lost altogether, you could certainly see a scenario where a lot of the new e-commerce customers might actually say, hey, you know, it's more convenient for me to go to a brick and mortar store. And I think if you're outside a major metro area, as we talk about time and again, if you're not ordering through a company that has an effective last mile service that they themselves control, or they have a partnership with a local company, it's going to be very, very difficult. Retailers like Duluth, for example, can't really control that last mile, so to speak. So they've got to rely on their shipping providers, for them, mostly UPS, to be able to deliver those packages on time. If that doesn't happen, of course, they risk losing customers. But also in markets where you have stores like that, it might make more sense for the consumer to go out of their house, to leave their house and get the product because they know it will be in their hand that day. And I know I've experienced my share of lost shipments. So far, I count 6 in the last 2 months alone from e-commerce sites. So if that's my experience, and I'm in a fairly reasonable metro area along the Front Range in Colorado, I can only imagine what's happening to, say, someone in Tulsa, Oklahoma, or Austin, Texas, or something along those lines. Now, to bring that all back to holiday sales and Deloitte's expectations, even with COVID, even with the existing momentum, even with the expectation of 25 to 35% growth in e-commerce, Deloitte is projecting between $182 billion and $196 billion in online sales this holiday season. Now, compare that to regular retail sales or overall retail sales. They're expecting $1.147 trillion to $1.152 trillion of overall retail sales. Just to break it down, even with all of this push towards e-commerce, Deloitte still expects e-commerce to only make up about 16% of overall retail sales. So we talk all the time about e-commerce and how it's important for companies to, you know, omni-channel, this, that, and the other thing. 84% of retail sales, even during a pandemic, even during a time where people are shopping through e-commerce sites, through apps more than they ever have, 84% of retail sales are expected to come through brick and mortar. Now, those projections might not be correct. It might be off by a percentage or two, but I don't think you're going to see it veer off by too much outside of that 84% expectation. Now, in talking about Deloitte's numbers, it's only fair that we talk about some of the other numbers that are coming out. NRF and others traditionally release their holiday expectations during October. It's going to be interesting this year because some say that holiday shopping could have already started in October, but we'll look forward to see what other prognosticators have to say about the holiday shopping season for the retail industry as a whole. Well, that'll do it for the news portion of the Retail Focus podcast. Coming up after this break, we'll talk with Nick Guillen and Nick Agiloni, the co-founders of Truff, about the process behind getting their product onto store shelves throughout the country. On the show, we often talk about retail from the retailer's perspective, and for good reason. We're the Retail Focus podcast, after all. However, how does retail appear from the product creator's point of view? While we've talked in the past about the process and procedure for the retail buyer, how does it look from the other side? Here to discuss the process behind consumable product creation and the quest for retail shelf space are Nick Guillen and Nick Agiloni, the co-founders of Truff and co-CEOs of Truff. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So first, rather than introduce the product myself, I wanted to give you both a chance to kind of discuss the Truff line of products and how the idea for the products came about in the first place.
Awesome. So Truff is a upscale lifestyle brand of hot sauce incorporating truffle as kind of the hero ingredient. The product came about, we didn't actually set out to make a hot sauce to start. Nick Guillen here, he had the Instagram name Sauce, S-A-U-C-E on Instagram. And we started out by building kind of a cool lifestyle media following, pictures that included food, pop culture, rappers, women, anything that would be considered saucy, basically, since the name of the account was Sauce. And along the way, the account started to, you know, gain momentum, get some traction, and we kind of came up with the idea to make a sauce that would fit well into that account. And so that was kind of the beginning stages. We wanted it to be a little bit more on the higher end of things, and we wanted to focus heavily on, you know, the digital aspect, the lifestyle aspect, and we wanted to use kind of our account that we were building as the home base for the sauce. And then, you know, we set out to figure out how to make what we would consider an amazing kind of higher end product. And after a couple of years, we ended up with Truff.
And to add on that, when we looked at the hot sauce category in retail, you know, we didn't see any luxury brand of hot sauce that existed on the market. And we also didn't see any brands that were going all in on social media. So those were, you know, a few pieces of inspiration, I guess you could say, that we took when we were creating the brand.
So we've talked a little bit about the development of the product itself, and it was pretty clear that you saw a void in the marketplace and kind of that premium spot on the hot sauce shelf. But when Truff started, what were the plans as far as selling the product? Obviously, digital, direct-to-consumer. What was the mix that you had in mind of direct-to-consumer versus the actual retail brick-and-mortar shelf space that you had in mind or were targeting there?
Yeah, so the goal was mainly to be all D2C to start. I think our whole premise was we didn't want to be at the mercy of the larger retailers and hope we can get on these shelves and who knows if we're going to get off the shelves. And so our goal was to sell direct and build the brand online and create, you know, a buzz and utilize our social media tools and influencers and whatnot to establish ourselves. You know, and our goal was when we were going to work with retailers at the beginning to kind of align with ones that fit our brand and our ethos. And we were lucky enough to get into accounts like Neiman Marcus and Wally's in Beverly Hills was one of our original accounts. And back when they were around, Dean and DeLuca was one of them. And so stores like that were, we thought were a good fit, and it kind of fit the brand. But other than that, it was mainly digitally focused.
So when you first started having the dialogue with those stores, whether they be domestic or overseas, obviously you had already a DTC portfolio. You could kind of put forth, hey, this is our brand. Hey, these are our sales. But what else was covered in that dialogue when you started talking to those retailers?
So I think to start, it was kind of a two-pronged approach. We had a lot of influx, a lot of inquiries from smaller gourmet specialty food stores that saw us on social media. They saw our ads, you know, on Facebook and Instagram. So we had a lot of inbound inquiries of customers already wanting to carry the product. Then we also had the outbound approach of going after some of these specialty stores, the, you know, wine and cheese stores, the olive oil, small 10 to 15 store chains. And we kind of did, you know, both of those at the same time.
So as you've mentioned already, you were in a series of certainly independent retailers, small chains. I know now you mentioned Neiman Marcus is an account, Bucky's, which is a iconic C-store chain in Texas, another one. Obviously, Whole Foods is another big one. What's the difference in interfacing with maybe an independent retailer or a smaller chain versus interfacing with a much larger company?
Yeah, I think the larger the company, the more detailed the process. Everything from, you know, logistics, the case size and the payment terms and, you know, free fill or no free fill and, you know, sometimes slotting, and it's a different sales cycle. Sometimes you have to work with the distributor versus shipping direct. There's a whole, I mean, as you kind of, each chain has their own kind of subtle process, but as you kind of go up the ladder, it's more of a project to make sure you're successful in that account.
Also to add, I think some of these larger chains, for example, Whole Foods and Wegmans, it's on a bigger stage. And I think we wanted to make sure we would perform very well. We weren't trying to get our product on the shelf and hope it sells. We wanted the timing to be right. So when we did get on the shelves in these, you know, big retail chains like Whole Foods, the product was already well known in the marketplace. People had seen it on social media, and they made the connection in the store. Wanted our performance to be as good as possible.
So we've talked a little bit about the social media presence, of course. I know that Truff does quite a bit of digital marketing as well. In just trying to study up for this interview, I've had Truff ads being popped up on my screen here for the last couple of weeks, so that's a good sign for you guys. But once you got into the retail stores, what were some of the things that you've used to maybe draw attention from the retail store customers? I know a lot of up-and-coming brands have maybe like brand ambassadors, or they work out co-op agreements. What were some of the things that you guys have worked on to make sure that the product does move off the shelves?
So I think we've done a good job internally on the digital side by helping support our retail accounts with letting our audience know and creating hype along the way that Truff would be available, or even do the opposite, like out of nowhere, let everyone know Truff is available nationally in Whole Foods, and it creates this sense of excitement and this sense of urgency and this ripple effect across all social media channels. And our customers and our audience, they get excited about that because they've been developing a relationship with the brand. We've been developing a relationship with them directly. But now they could then go to one of their favorite stores and purchase it. We've also done things like, you know, we've run campaigns letting our customers know that product is in store at Wegmans, Whole Foods, Central Market, and different accounts that we launched with.
And then adding to that, I guess, in terms of like in-store, I mean, prior to COVID, we could do, you know, demos, for example, and that's since not been so active, of course. And then, you know, other things like sometimes we're on promo, or for example with Whole Foods we did a cool, and it's still going today, it's like a Truff chicken sandwich collaboration in some of their hot kitchen environments, and that's a cool little way to get a little bit deeper with their customer and our followers and offer something that they can go there and try the product and then also purchase it if they like it. with Central Market. I think we did a cool social media post together with them. Anything to really support the retailer. And we like to do our job. We don't, I know retailers are always needing help getting products to move sometimes. And we want to be one of those brands that are doing everything we can to support them.
So now that you've got the shelf space in the likes of the Whole Foods and the Wegmans, you mentioned the partnership between both you and the store, making sure the product moves, doing your part. But what else are you doing, or what else might the outsider not realize goes on in terms of just continuing to make sure that relationship is strong going into the future and making sure that you can maintain that shelf space in those retailers?
I think one thing that works in all of our retailers' favor is our exposure as a brand. I mean, it's very common that even in our early days when we were working with the independents, they'd come in and these are stores that didn't even want to take a chance on us. And we would literally be like, hey, if it doesn't sell, we'll buy it back. Like, give it 4 weeks. And sure enough, they'd let us know, hey, people came in and they've seen this online and they bought 4 bottles. And we're like, hey, I know. I mean, the exposure is what we were letting you know about in the first place. And so that's always worked in the retailer's favor. And that's, we put it on ourselves to make sure that the exposure is there and the awareness is there. And I think that starts us off on the right foot with them and, you know, continues to carry on with just good velocity. And they see this as a brand that isn't just a quick, you know, get on the shelf and make a quick buck, but there's a repeat customer rate there. There's a high volume audience that really loves this product and brand, and they're going to support it continuously.
Now, I'm kind of curious because, again, this is a premium hot sauce. And when we say premium hot sauce, it's not like it's $100. You can get a bottle of Truff for under $20. So it's still a very reasonable purchase for those that are into gourmet food. But what are some considerations that you have when marketing a premium product like Truff, not only to retailers, but also directly to the consumers versus maybe a budget product like, you know, Tabasco in this space would market their product towards retailers?
So I think with respect to marketing and creating things for our customers, you know, followers and potential buyers to see, we want to create content. We want to have a voice behind that content that's very relatable to the consumer and the person viewing it. We do see ourselves as a high-end prestigious brand, but we don't want that to get lost in the translation of how we communicate with these customers. So creating content that could be just filmed on an iPhone, someone at home making a recipe, showing us how they enjoy the use of our product. Also doing some of the higher end, highbrow stuff with, you know, a little bit more higher end of cameras and sexy sauce pouring on food and really cool, visually stimulating bits of content as well. And seeing what resonates well and what's best viewed by our customers and continuing to produce things that they like.
And adding what Nick said in relation to, you're kind of referring to price point as well. One of the things we do with all of the content that Nick was talking about is we also, I guess the word would be educate, good dishes to use Truff on. We featured Real Black Truffles. We're telling the story of Truff through content. And in that story, you understand why it is a little bit more premium, why it may cost a little bit more. But it's not just sitting on the shelf at a high price point, but we're also, you know, showing you why and what goes into it and all that kind of stuff.
Now, I wanted to get a little bit off of the beaten track here because I did see Truff in, we were traveling through the Dakotas last week, and there's a retail store, Modern and Farmhouse, that has Truff. And seeing the label, seeing the product, it just jumps off the shelf at you compared to a lot of these other products. You know, a lot of these other products have maybe a shtick that they're going with, but the Truff label just seems so well done. What was the thought process behind the design of the packaging to make sure it would stand out to consumers, not only in retail stores, but online as well?
Yeah, our packaging, as I think we were talking about early on, but we were, you know, digital first. And so we wanted to create a brand that could live online and be very easy to understand what it is online. And if you look at our label, it says Truff, you know, very clearly down the front. You can't really miss that. We incorporate the geometric side of what a truffle looks like into our cap, which is also visually appealing and kind of, I guess you could say, mimics some of like the alcohol type bottles where it's a little bit more flashy and a little bit more easier to resonate with. And then when you do compare it to the products on the shelf, I think the majority of sauces are packaged in kind of a more similar looking woozy bottle with a regular cap and kind of a more generic label, where we wanted to kind of go the other way with it and make sure that if there is a line of hot sauces that you at least pick up Truff and say, ooh, what's this? Or, oh, this one's interesting, or what, you know, it should catch your eye. And so that was the goal. It was an endeavor that had to be fully custom. So our packaging is entirely custom. And, you know, we've had to maneuver accordingly from all angles in terms of like manufacturing with custom packaging and whatnot and all those different aspects. But the idea was to stand out in the category, and we wanted our packaging to tell the story of what was inside the bottle.
Not to fall too deep down the rabbit hole, if you will, but I think the lid in and of itself is somewhat of an accomplishment. You know, oftentimes if you're a food producer, you go with, you know, regular size lids, regular size bottles, that type of thing. What was maybe an obstacle that had to be overcome in terms of designing that lid, getting that lid produced?
I mean, there's a lot, right? I mean, there's no equipment that's made for our packaging. We've had to learn and develop processes that we can scale our manufacturing. The lid itself is, you know, it took a lot to get to that lid. I know it looks simple and luxe right now, but we didn't start with that. And, you know, it's custom. We've had to engineer it, build molds around it, make sure we can, you know, make the enough with the molds and, you know, continuously develop that process alone. And then little subtle things, you know, making sure it's food safe and making sure it's going to be something that is user friendly with the consumer and all those types of things. So there is a lot that goes into custom. I mean, if you look at the bottom of a Truff bottle, it says Truff and embossed in the glass. It's a little detail. Most people probably don't notice it, but to us, it's very important and we love having it there. Even like the ridges around the bottom of the label itself and the gold foil and the matte finish. I mean, it's all very much so all for a reason. And we spent a lot of time getting to that, although it may look simple when you look at it right now.
Yeah, everything about it appears very intentional and certainly very on brand. Well, I wanted to end on this. What's next for Truff as you continue to not only build the brand, but also build your product line?
So I think we want to continue creating exciting products and exciting experiences for our customers that help elevate their dining experience.
Yeah. And I guess in addition to that, what's next is, you know, continuing to do what we're doing, but, you know, bigger and better. We are, after 2.5 roughly years, we've continued to build out our retail program. We've brought on a new VP of sales, Reno Giannis, and he has been helping us tremendously understand retail on a level that we didn't quite in the beginning and help us to continue to build our business in retail. And so we could be more of an omni-channel business and have our amazing online customers and also have the amazing retail shopper.
Fantastic stuff. Well, we'll look forward to certainly watching it scale here over the next, hopefully, 2.5, 5, 10, 20 years. So interesting stuff. And both of you, I appreciate you joining us here today on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having us.
Absolutely. Appreciate you having us and congrats on your podcast. It's an awesome show.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we thank the two Nicks for joining us here on the podcast. And if you haven't checked out Truff, if you haven't tried it out, or you haven't even seen the product, you can certainly go to their website, which is simply truffhotsauce.com, T-R-U-F-F hotsauce.com. You can also check them out there in Whole Foods stores throughout the country, Wegmans on the East Coast, as we mentioned, Bucky's in the South, and they are looking to expand their retail marketing. And you can actually look up the stores that they're in specific on their website. There's a lot of independent retailers that are out there as well. And I highly encourage you just to see their packaging, because the packaging that we were talking about, the caps assembled by hand, for example, really unique for a retail product. And it's not something you see a whole lot of in terms of innovation with packaging currently in the grocery space. So hopefully you'll see more of that, and hopefully you'll see more brands get creative with that. So let's talk about stories we're looking ahead to for the next week. And I'm looking ahead to this coming Tuesday, September 22nd. And why? Because this Tuesday is when a couple of retail companies will release earnings. One is AutoZone. The reason I'm looking ahead to this, and we always talk about once a quarter, we talk about one of the auto parts retailers that are out there, AutoZone, Advance Auto Parts, and O'Reilly. We always rotate between one of them. But again, we get a chance to see 3 months worth of pandemic buying conditions. And the reason I think this is important is because there is some general disagreement or some mixed messaging, I think would be the better way to put it, regarding how auto parts retailers do during times of unemployment, during times of recession. And some people say, well, auto parts retailers do really well because people are more willing to do repairs themselves to try and save on money versus taking their vehicle to a repair shop and paying someone else to do it. So they're trying to save money. Same thing even with oil changes and the like. The other part of it says, well, during times of recession, during times of high unemployment, people wait to make changes to their automobile. Let's say your AC goes out and you're furloughed from work. You might wait until after income picks back up to make some of those changes. So that's the reason I'm looking ahead to this earnings call. And I'm going to be looking ahead certainly to all of the earnings calls from the auto parts retailers just to see what management says about the trends that they are seeing. And it's basically just another data point in the coffer. Now, if you were to look at the stock market, they're not what we would call a negative beta stock. In fact, for most auto parts companies, their beta is around one, which means basically the stock goes up or down as the rest of the stock market goes up or down as a whole. On the retail front, though, in the past, auto parts retailers have seen better than average sales compared to retailers in other segments during times of recessionary pressure. So that's the first earnings call I'm looking at. The second is the earnings call from Stitch Fix. Now, Stitch Fix is expected to show a loss in this upcoming quarter, but the reason I'm looking ahead to this earnings call on Tuesday is because, again, people aren't buying apparel as much anymore, but we know that people are certainly funneling apparel purchases to the likes of Walmart and Dollar General and Target, all of whom have seen some measure of momentum in those categories since the pandemic started. Stitch Fix, as an online pure play clothing retailer, I'm anxious to see if they've seen subscriptions go up or down as a result of the pandemic, and overall what the company says regarding shipping. Again, very important for retailers like Stitch Fix to be able to get merchandise to customers on time. So where are the subscription numbers coming in at for Stitch Fix? And also, what are they seeing as far as shipping pressures? Because we've gotten some great information regarding shipping on earnings calls from the likes of Chewy and Duluth, as we've talked about on this show. Stitch Fix, again, another data point, just like AutoZone, in showing us kind of where shipping might be here in the U.S. retail industry and for e-commerce over the next 3 to 4 months. So those are the stories we're looking ahead to. No podcast during the week coming up, but next weekend we'll be back with a podcast. We're going to speak with Sarah Fisher. Fisher is the owner of Nature's Pantry Farm in Minnesota. She's going to actually be joining the show to discuss some of the idiosyncrasies behind retailing directly from a farm to the consumer. And I think this is interesting because we overlook farmers markets and direct-to-consumer from farms all the time. Yet we see farm stands everywhere. There's a farmers market in every city in the United States, multiple of them, of course. Farmers market sales bring in a ton of money annually, and yet this is not something that we spend a lot of time talking about. So she's going to talk about the communication necessary with customers, how you go through managing customers, and more importantly, how you plan, because farmers don't have the capability to snap their fingers and say, oh, we're going to order more of product X and have it in. They have to plan years in advance, especially in terms of meat producing farmers, to make sure they have the inventory necessary for the families that are depending on them for this product. So for that reason, it's an interesting discussion. The other neat thing about Sarah's farm is basically she's completely vertically integrated. So she controls the supply chain, she controls the inputs of the product, she also controls the sales and the outputs and the pricing and the merchandising and all of that. So it's It's going to be fantastic to have her on the show next week, and I certainly hope you'll join us, even though it's not what many would consider a traditional retail subject. So for everyone that makes this podcast possible, including Leighton on the back end, I'm Trent Kling, saying so long until next week.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.